The reason people aren't financially free is they don't know what to do and they don't know where to start. I want you to join Joey and I at the Virtual Inner Circle Live, April the 4th through the 6th, as we share with you the exact answers to those questions. We only do this event one time per year. I don't want you to miss out. Go to wealthwalkwallstreet.com/live and enter promo code podcast. When you're at this event, you're going to get your investor DNA. You're going to get access to up to 6 different passive income strategies. So you know, leaving this event, exactly what to do, taking our decades of knowledge so that you can start becoming financially free. Go to wealthwalkwallstreet.com/live and enter the promo code podcast.
Joey, one of my favorite movies of all time is Tommy Boy. Having Chris Farley and David Spade in the same place, they're just funny to look at, much less listen to.
Pure cinema magic right there.
I think about today's episode as we're talking about, is index universal life, that's a type of permanent life insurance policy, is it good for IBC, infinite banking concept? And I started thinking about Tommy Boy, Joey. The scene where Chris Farley puts on David Spade's little blazer.
Yep.
And he starts dancing around, fat guy in a little coat. Fat guy in a little coat.
That is perfectly fitting, no pun intended, for today's episode.
Because what ended up happening to that coat?
That thing tore down the middle.
So maybe a fat guy in a little coat was not a good fit. I think we might be foreshadowing this episode on, is IUL good for IBC? Let's find out and belly up.
Welcome to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast, your guide to understanding how to get out of the Wall Street rat race and start your own mailbox money lifestyle. Now, don't let these handsome Southern draws fool you. These financial minds are teaching our country to enhance savings, increase cash flow, and create passive income, all without the help of Wall Street. Are you ready to break through? Now, here are your hosts, Russ Morgan and Joey Murray.
Welcome into the IBC Roundtable, where every week we break down different topics revolving around the infinite banking process, concept, system, however you want to look at it. And it's a forum, a table, a lot of men. To my right, I've got one of those, the Italian stallion, Mr. Joey Murray. What's up, Joey?
Spoken like a true Southerner, Italian.
Italian.
There you go. Happy to be here.
Glad that you're here. To your right, another familiar face, the Indiana Jones of finance, the man that goes deep into your finances looking for gold, Mr. Downtown Ernie Brown. What's up, Ernie?
Hey, Russ. Good afternoon. I don't know about this Indiana Jones stuff.
I like it. And across the board from me, I've got the million-dollar smile, the Mr. Incredible, the man that can eat a hamburger at every Zoom call and help answer any financial strategy question that you have, Mr. J.D. Hill. What's up, J.D.?
How's everybody doing?
I am wonderful.
Fantastic.
Good morning.
I'm kind of liking the hamburger comment. I like that. Thank you for that's a wonderful compliment for me.
I know it is. You are definitely the Gordon Ramsay of Zoom calls.
I am a food connoisseur without a doubt, yes. Particularly on Zoom calls.
Yeah, what's the guy from Diners and Dives?
Guy Fieri?
Yeah. What the other? Right. All right. And last but not least, our resident pilot, the man that helps you get to your financial destination safely, Mark Haraguchi. What's up, Mark?
Another day, guys. It's Thursday. It's another roundtable. What do we got on tap?
Well, today we're breaking down a really, I would say, somewhat controversial sometimes. We've been in this world of kind of going around index universal life and talking about, is it a good fit? And I would, you know, start with you, Mark. You came to me a couple of years back and we were talking about infinite banking. And you showed me some policies that you had set up. One of those was an infinite banking style policy, but it was done through the lens and through the use of index universal life. So let's talk about, is index universal life good for IBC?
That's a loaded question there, Russ. You know, in the frame and the context that we are approaching this from, Ernie had a great, you know, I thought lead off for this one in our discussions was, you know, what is our context for IBC? Where is our like original, you know, thought of IBC coming from? And it's Nelson Nash.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, being able to be introduced to that level of understanding, that education through the Becoming Your Own Banker book and talks with you, you know, I was given the information I needed to recognize that that was not a tool that I wanted to use for the infinite banking concept.
Well, so Joey, for those who may not be as familiar with Index Universal Life, how, let's start framing this conversation because I don't want to leave anybody behind. And you're probably one of them. I don't want to get lost in this.
Seriously.
Let's talk about what Index Universal Life is.
Okay. So first and foremost, I'm going to be hazy on some of the details around Index Universal Life, like when it came into being and all that. But I could tell you generally, and it kind of goes back to what Mark just said in Becoming Your Own Banker, Nelson Nash would tell you that Index Universal Life was a response to the market. Right? It was a way that insurance companies were not able, their agents were clamoring saying, hey, the markets are up too high. I can't sell life insurance. So what can we do? And it became a way to take advantage of the indexes in the stock market, along with tacking on a death benefit.
All right, hold on. Let's back up a little bit. I like where you're going there, but I don't want to lose premise. So Universal Life as a whole took a side investment paired with insurance, put them together in order to do exactly what you said, to try to offset or compete with what was happening in the market. So Universal Life came up on the stage late 70s, early 80s in the, as we all know, high interest rate environment, right? And that was to, you know, the traditional typical whole life policies, which were fixed, had all these guarantees set. They couldn't adjust for current market assumptions.
Especially not super quickly.
And so then in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, we saw variable universal life come on the stage. And variable universal life was taking insurance and then pairing it off into a side account that invested in mutual funds. Well, obviously the market had a great run in the 90s, but what happened with in late 99, 2000, 2001, we had the dot-com crash.
Right.
That is why Index Universal Life came on the stage was, okay, I want the upside, but I don't want the downside that happened with my mutual funds.
That's
so
right.
Just so you know, when did IUL come on the stage? Early 2000, shortly after the dot-com bubble.
I knew you would know, Russ.
Well, I just wanted to make sure you were on the same page with us.
but essentially, to your point, it was a way of basically taking an investment vehicle and then tacking on life insurance. And in fact, it's really, if you want to compare it to whole life, it's like having a totally different chassis. So like, for instance, a truck chassis versus a Corolla chassis, they're going to be totally different, right? And that's exactly what we've got here between Index Universal Life and whole life.
All right, JD, what would you say? What fill in some of the blanks that where Joey and I missed on explaining exactly what Index Universal Life is? Because I want to make sure we clarify what it is, and then we can talk about, is it good for IBC?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think you guys did a really good job. You know, I think practically speaking, like IUL is supposed to be a risk mitigation tool, right? So if you just fundamentally just look at it, it's quote unquote upside potential with downside protection, right? So it's designed to be a risk mitigation tool, yet it's oftentimes positioned to people as an upside tool, right? And I think that's where sometimes people can get in trouble or you know, with it. It's just fundamentally just that right there. But then we have to, I think, understand what IUL is built off of. Right. And it's built off of universal life, which is what y'all had explained in the beginning. And I think what's important to note about just universal life in general is when you look at an illustration, for example, these illustrations assume a couple of things, right? They assume a constant rate of return and a constant cost of insurance scale. I don't know if you want to go into this right now or not, but you know, I think fundamentally when you get into kind of the mechanics of what's happening behind the scenes, that can really help to lay the framework for, you know, where does this actually become a fit and where is it not a fit? Because I'm of the belief that there's no such thing as a bad tool, just a misapplication of the tool.
No doubt. I agree 100%. I do want to dive deeper into that. And some of the other things that we didn't hit on was the flexibility of its premium, right? That mm-hmm. is one of the yeah. major components, one of the pros that people have of wanting to use universal life of any sort is the ability to be more flexible with how they make their payments or premiums. Now, Ernie, we always take things back to Nelson Nash's book, Becoming Your Own Banker, because I think he's the one that has given us this vision for how to store cash. So what does Nelson say in his book, Becoming Your Own Banker, about universal life?
Yeah, he's got a section, My Thoughts on Universal Life and Variable Life. It's page 39. He says several things, but some highlights in what you said, talking about universal life, is that it's one-year term insurance with a side fund and an interest-bearing account. What he says, it was an attempt to unbundle the savings element and the life insurance element of a whole life policy. And then he said, this was created, what we've already said, in a time of high interest rates. It looked good in the early years, but when we talk about this policy being built on the chassis of one-year term insurance, he says, when I first ran it, it looked good in the early years. But then he kept running illustrations and saw them falling apart when the insured age reached, when the insured attained 65 or 70, where the one-year term became prohibitive in the advanced years and ate up the cash fund from that point forward. So what you're talking about, the flexibility of the premium, it's sold with this idea, we'll get great rate of return and you'll have the ability at some point to stop paying premium.
Ooh, now see, there goes into our selfish greed, right? I think there's a point within Wall Street that we all see, because when we see the market going up, what do we also see happen with savings rates as a whole?
Going down.
Why is that so?
Because we figure if I can put in less and get the same amount of return.
Same amount of dollars.
Yeah, exactly. Same dollars amount because my percentage went up. Well, why wouldn't I do that?
And this is the case. We've seen this as we've seen the market rise. People are saving less and less and less. And now some of that has to do with the Federal Reserve. And we don't have to go too deep into that. But when interest rates are so low, people go spend money. And that is a true objective of the Federal Reserve, to lower interest rate. And when you make interest rates so low, people don't want to save it, even though correspondingly, the companies that are selling all these things are experiencing high growth, which that's what you see in the stock market growth. Well, here's another thing I think people, and I remember I was, you got to understand, I came from the financial sector. I was a Wall Street junkie. I was a certified financial planner. And when I started trying to figure out, okay, people are looking for growth, they're looking for tax benefits, and I found these things called variable universal life and index universal life, I thought I have found the perfect combination, because who doesn't want lots of growth that is tax-free? You can't get any
cake and eat it too.
You can't get anything better. And we used to say too, this is like a Roth IRA on steroids. Now, the only problem is with the Roth IRA, someone couldn't put a whole bunch of money in it, right? And so we would say, that's the steroids. You can actually do more. You can get bigger, right? In a good way, you can get bigger. But as a tool, I think I want to like really be clear as we start to compare it. Is IUL good for IBC? One of the things that I knew that it was created for was it was created for accumulation and ultimately distribution. So let's put that in context, Mark, of our four steps. Once we're clear in step one of what we want to do with money, what is step two? What are we really trying to do in step two?
Step two is taking control. We want control over our system, over our finances, over creating this bucket of opportunity.
So when you have control, you have access to the money, then you do what with it, Ernie?
Then you chart your path. You pick a passive income path.
So then you have to go get money out of your control sector, right? Out of your place where you've put it.
Where we're storing it.
Right. In order to go buy assets to produce cash flow.
Where we want to invest.
All right. So let's talk about that section, Joey. How does IUL perform in ways of getting access to the money to go buy assets with in its first couple of years?
Well, I can tell you from a personal story. I met with a client maybe about a year and a half ago, and he came to me and he's so fired up. He's like, man, I'm so glad I found your podcast. I've actually been doing this infinite banking thing for a couple years now. I got fired up about it. I brought my book to my financial guy, my insurance guy, and he set me up on these policies. I just want to do some more with you guys. And I'm like, okay, well, just let me take a look. And he sends me over two policies, and he's been putting $75,000 a year per person into IUL policies. And I said, wow, okay, well, somebody actually set you up on a policy that's not mentioned in Nelson's book, except in a negative connotation to this concept. And when we looked at it closely, he had these terrible things called surrender charges. The surrender charges ate up out of $150,000 of contributions over 2 years, these premiums he's put in per person. This was $300,000 total. He had about $80,000 between the two policies. And the rest of it was completely eaten up with surrender charges. And he was shocked.
So he had about 20% of what he put in there.
Yes.
So let's talk about, I mean, you said terrible. And I would say, let's be careful, right? Because again, all tools were created with a purpose. And I think about this. We went, the three of us here on this side, got to go play golf. JD, Mark, apologize. You guys didn't get the offer. I just didn't feel like you'd want to fly over here to get to go on the trip with us. But we went and played golf. And I know we play 18 holes, and about five or six of those are par threes. And as much as we love to hit the big dog and let it run, when you're on a par three, that doesn't make sense. You can't just keep whipping out the driver, can you?
No.
It's the wrong tool on the wrong hole.
That's right.
And so what I would say to what you were talking about, surrender charges, the reason the surrender charges are built in an IUL, or let me ask this, why do you believe surrender charges are built in a IUL product? What would be a thought process there?
Well, the insurance company is built a product where they are guaranteeing that they're going to be profitable because they are liable for the death benefit on the back end.
Okay.
So one thing is they've got to cover the cost.
All right. So Joey, you and I have hired a lot of different marketing people over the years, and to share the podcast, to share video production, all these different things. And we know, where is most of their time spent, in the early years or in the later?
All up front. Yeah. If you can build it right from the day one, it's just maintenance from there.
So they what do they want? Do they want like a month-to-month commitment from you right off the bat, or do they want you to sign a 6-month, 2-year contract?
They want to make it long-term, and they want to make it heavy on the front end.
Why?
Because they know that they're never going to be paid for their effort on the front end or over a long period of time, if you were to leave in 3 months or 4 months. Or
right. 5 months, it requires a lot of heavy weight on the front end to get all of those things going. So when you think about that from that lens now, why do you believe insurance companies put heavy surrender charges on products like IUL?
Because they've got to recoup the costs that they've paid.
They got to recoup. It is what they're saying is a long-term product. In order for them to create all of these things that you want on the front end, which we will not go into all those things. I mean, there's plenty of videos you can go look at to see how complex these are. And I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying that's the reason why they're that way. So when you look at it from our framework of getting money in our control and then turning around and putting it to work, JD, and passive income, how does an accumulation asset work in comparison to a whole life policy, which is more meant for us to be in and out of?
So, you know, in a whole life policy, there isn't implicit surrender charges, right? So whatever the cash value is in a whole life policy, that is effectively the cash surrender value. There aren't two different balances, if you will. a cash value accumulation balance or and then a net cash surrender value if you wanted to walk away. They're the same dollar amounts. And so that makes it much more, go ahead.
No, as a maybe a clearer response for the person listening who doesn't understand all of these little things that we talk about all the time. Talk about an example of the last policy you created. How much as a percentage, what percentage of money was available for that person to take a loan from?
About 82-83%.
So as you compare that to the example you gave a second ago of roughly 20-25%, that
was after 2 years.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
But, and see, that's the thing I think that what we need to understand is, like you said, Mark, early, is that there's different tools. And we know that there's not good or bad, but we just need to find the one that fits. But playing into our greed, we see return. And I think that that's one of the biggest reasons why some people get kind of drawn into the index universal life part of this discussion. Oh, well, I like infinite banking. I like the idea of creating passive income streams. Well, why wouldn't, if I could get a tool that could give me 5 or 6% instead of 3 to 5%, why wouldn't I choose that?
Well, exactly. And I think it's because we're thinking in terms of the accumulation aspect. And I think this is exactly why we have our 4-step process. Because if at the very beginning of our process, you get clear on what you want and it doesn't include taking control, then you never move to the next step, right? If you're of the mindset that I need to just put money blindly into something and put my head in the sand and hope that it works out, then it really doesn't make sense for you to go down this path. Infinite banking is not for you. I mean, how many times have people asked Russ, you and I over the years, well, who is infinite banking not for? I think I've got a new answer. At this point,
tell me,
it's if you don't want to take control of your own finances, don't do it. Right. I mean, be honest, if you just want someone else to manage your money and you just want, you know, you're not concerned about the results and you really aren't going to be engaged with that process, then this isn't for you. But if you want to take that control, then you have to put it in the best location to access and to grow and to then maximize and optimize that money. And that's where I think, if we're really clear on what infinite banking is, that's what it really amounts to in my mind.
Mark, what do you have to say about this? Been quiet lately.
Well, I'm just, I was trying to see if I could blend in with my background and almost made it. I agree with what everybody said. And I think, you know, to take Joey's one a step further is having the right tool and having something that you can consistently rely on to be there for you when you need it, to be that bedrock is, I'll take the slow and steady growth because I know it's going to be there versus the potential for maybe conceivably more growth within it. But then you also have that risk of, well, there might actually then be even less growth, right? Because for every positive, there's got to be a negative, and for every negative, there's got to be a positive. So everything is a give and a take. So I'm happy with the slow and steady, and I'm happy removing risk from a part of my financial system, like my control. I don't want that level of risk because I don't need it.
Well, I love the way you said that. It made me think of a story. So several years back, I went skiing with my brother-in-law, and I hadn't been in a while. And when the first chairlift, we're going up, and there's two ski instructors. It happens to be on their day off or morning off or whatever. And they're going up and I'm like asking them for tips. And they said, well, here's the thing is, like, we work with a lot of usually spouses, wives of people that are skiing for the first time. And what we commonly hear them tell us is that I just don't want to go fast. And I'm like, well, oh, okay. Yeah. And he goes, you know, the biggest issue, I think, that when we're hearing that, we always say, well, do you ever drive faster than the speed limit in your car? And they say, sure. And you go, well, why do you feel comfortable doing that? Well, because I know I'm in control. I can stop when I want to. He said, so really what they want to be is in control, our second step, right? Because when you're not in control, that's when risk creeps up. That's when we start getting afraid. And so, long way of telling you, are you comfortable in being able to stop? I was like, well, I don't know. He said, I would work on that. The first, you know, first hill that you're going down, constantly try to stop. Try to figure out, can you stop when you want to? And when you do that, you can get going faster and faster and faster because you'll feel in control. And I think that's related really well to what we're talking about, is that the reason we use whole life policies, and JD, I'm going to let you say this much better than I do, it has three main ingredients that don't exist within IULs.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to try to slide that in there at some point. But whole life insurance fundamentally has three material guarantees that you don't get inside of a UL or an IUL contract. And I use the word material because I think it's important, because it is material to the contract staying in force, right? And the first thing is that it has a guaranteed premium, right? So actuarially, as long as you fund and make the guaranteed premium, the insurance company is obligated. They're contractually required to honor the contract. It also has a guaranteed cash value. So the insurance company is guaranteeing that the cash value is going to grow, right, on a scale, no matter what happens every year. And then it also has a guaranteed death benefit, right? And so I just think fundamentally, if you look at the certainty that we're talking about, right, you get certainty inside of guarantees, right? We don't get certainty chasing something that we don't know is actually going to happen or not, right? That's uncertainty. And so I think it's important, right, that again, the whole, and again, that doesn't make UL or IUL bad, but in the context of what we're talking about, right, those three material guarantees are so crucial, particularly if you look at like the way that they calculate the premium, right, on a universal life insurance policy is based on keeping a few things constant and then back calculating it, assuming that these two things remain constant throughout the life of the policy, which is why it's called a target premium, right? And if anybody's ever got any shooting or anything like that, like targets can move, right? And I think that's important to know, like it's a target premium for a reason, because that target can move if the things that you're looking at on paper today actually change over time, and we know undoubtedly that they will.
So Ernie, let me ask you this. Insurance companies, especially the ones that we work with, right, we work with five or six different companies, and on average they've been around 150 years. What percentage of their money are they investing in these derivatives, which is what's made up, what this, how these index universal life products work? They're going out and they're spending money to buy derivatives in the investment banking world that then will trail the market and can take advantage of it when it goes up, and they just lose the money when it goes down. How much of the insurance companies' money that we've been working with for 150 years, that's been around 150 years, how much of their money are they putting in derivatives?
For a typical insurance policy, it's, or a company, very little.
Yeah. Sometimes you don't even see it at all. It's zero. It doesn't exist. Now, Joey, why would an insurance company sell a product that they don't actually invest their own money in?
It's very profitable. It's very profitable for the insurance company, because really essentially what they've done is they have transferred the risk that they, as JD just explained so well, they've inherently taken themselves on as the person that's providing the risk coverage. Insurance is all about risk.
It's all about replacing.
Right. Replacing, yeah.
It's a replacement of something. And what you're saying is that they're transferring it to somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. They're giving people, and again, you can spin this however you want. It's like, oh, well, we want you to be able to take advantage of the upside when the market is high. So in trade-off of that, you also have to be concerned about the downside. You have to be concerned about the actual cost of insurance, and the things that are naturally taken care of when the insurance company takes on all the risk in like a whole life contract.
Well, I think here's the thing is that, let me ask the question. I'll go around the table. Is IUL good for IBC, Mark?
I don't have it in my portfolio.
Well, you used to.
I used to, but then I've changed course. I learned some things that there was risk that I did not want to involve in my system. So I personally do not have IUL as a foundation of my IBC system.
Key word there, by the way. He just said something really key: foundation of my IBC system. And I think that's a really key thing. JD?
Yeah, I'm going to go with it's going to be a no for me, dog.
Ernie, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I won't give you my answer because I don't think it's that important. I'll give you what Nelson says in his book, kind of the end of that. He says two things. He says, I suggest you read these books. Upon completion of these books, you should be adequately informed. So first answer, be educated on the product. If you don't understand how it works, don't invest into it. Mm. And then secondly, what Nelson says was, I never sold one of these policies. I would never buy one. I do not recommend its use for the infinite banking concept.
Mm. Mic drop.
Well, I think from that perspective, right, if we're going to use Nelson Nash, the person who gave us this book, Becoming Your Own Banker, that helped us see the light as it relates to life insurance as a tool, as a foundational tool for our cash, not the investment, not the end place, because our goal is not accumulation. Our goal is to get our time back.
Exactly.
And we need a process and a plan to do that. And IBC just is one of those steps or one of those tools using whole life insurance to help us get there on our path, on our journey.
Yeah. And I would just add to that. You just pointed it out. We don't need to get gray on what is the savings component and what is the investment component. They cannot be the same. In this case, unless you are literally, like I said before, trying to just put your head in the sand, not take control of your finances, then and only then would you just use an accumulation vehicle. It's just not the right vehicle. It's kind of like when I went to buy my Yukon recently, I just would never have bought the little two-seater sports car. I have five kids. It's not the right vehicle.
Yes, I don't think you would look good in a two-seater. That would not fit you very well. Well, thank you. I hope this was helpful. And by the way, if you would love to know how we break down Index Universal Life and we compare it to whole life, you can come back and watch the recording of this as long as you're an Inner Circle member. All you have to do is go to wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/innercircle and go to the events page and hit pass. And you can go and see what everyone else who's on our call right now with us live is about to see as we break down an IUL policy and start looking at it as compared to a whole life policy of similar nature. So thank you for listening to this episode. And as always, have an amazing day.
This has been the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show to break free of the Wall Street mindset and begin building wealth on your own terms in places you understand so that your wealth will never run dry. See you next episode.